Consequence Podcast Network.
This week on The Sidetrack, we'll be joined by writer, producer, and actress Sarah Megan Thomas, here to talk about her new film, A Call to Spy, and then Fincher's ultimate film from 2010, The Social Network. That's this week on The Sidetrack. Welcome back to yet another edition of The Sidetrack. It's me, still your host, Paul Davidson. Clearly, we went corporate, joined the Consequence of Sound podcast network, but I'm still here. At some point, maybe they'll switch me out for somebody like John Stamos. No, that won't happen. I'm here to stay. So if you're not feeling it, if you're not feeling the vibe, then there's 732,000 other podcasts. In any case, I kid. This week, as mentioned in the opener, we are joined by writer, producer, actress, triple threat, Sarah Megan Thomas, who not only has a new movie that's out in theaters and on digital as of October, A Call to Spy, which is a fascinating, inspired by true events story of women, female spies, not women spies, as created by Winston Churchill, his secret army in World War II, fighting the Germans. Quite an interesting story, inspired by true events, and we'll find out a bit about that. But what's even more fascinating, perhaps, is that this week, this episode represents the third in a trilogy of our Philly episodes. We had Matt Spicer, we had Dylan Galula, and now we have Sarah Megan Thomas, all hailing from the city where there is a huge statue of Rocky at the top of the stairs. That, of course, is a non-Philly-born individual's assumption and awareness of the town. But there's much more to it, and we'll talk a little bit about that. In addition to that, what's interesting for Sarah Megan Thomas, and do you have to say all three names? I think it's one of those things. You must say the Megan of Sarah Megan Thomas. She acted in and wrote the story that the film Equity was based on. That was a Sundance film in 2016 starring Anna Gunn from Breaking Bad. And I remember going into Sundance 2016, and that was a movie that we had identified as, this is interesting, you know, the stock market, female-driven project. But of course, it was snatched away the night before the Sundance Film Festival even began. And I remember feeling the defeat before the battle had even begun. We'll chat a little bit about that. So, why don't we just get started? Without further ado, sitting down here on The Sidetrack, our guest this week, Sarah Megan Thomas. And as promised, here we are joined by Sarah Megan Thomas. Sarah, how are you today?
I am great. How are you?
Doing well. Now, I have to start by asking the most mundane question, but if you know me, you know that I'm obsessed with the little details. At what point did we decide, we being you, that you were going to go with all three names, the first, the middle, and the last? I know that there was a moment where you had to think through this. How did this all come about?
I love that question. You know, no one's ever asked me that. So this all came about because when you go to register for your SAG card, you cannot take another name, right? Right. And Sarah and Thomas are very popular names. And Sarah Thomas is a gorgeous British model / actress, I believe. And so anyway, that name was taken. So basically it was change your name or go with Megan Thomas, which was just weird,
right?
Or do all three. So nobody really calls me Sarah Megan Thomas. Everyone calls me Sarah, but for screen and also my legal name, I'm married, is Sarah Donahue. So it's very interesting trying to find me.
So your legal name is, so your married name is Donahue, but do you, when you get the electric bill in the mail, is it to Sarah Donahue?
Yeah, totally. So it's like, it's really fun because I can play games of which name right. I give you, and they're both true.
I figured that was the reason behind it, but I had to ask. The other thing that I'll mention, And again, I'm obsessed with kind of the, I'm one of those, I'm like the sliding doors guy, like the 6 degrees of separation. I love to look at the world and figure out like, how is all the energy of all these people crossing paths? What's fascinating is this episode represents the third in a trilogy of Philly-based conversations. So,
really?
So we had an episode with Matt Spicer, who directed and wrote Ingrid Goes West. We did an episode with Dylan Galula, who is an actress who was in Support the Girls. Both have, you know, grew up in Philly. Now, I'm right to say you grew up in Philly and then continued to kind of live there and film there and things like that, right?
Well, yes, I grew up in Philly, and I actually, until the pandemic, lived in Soho, New York, but I bring all my films back to Philly, right. Because it's the home team and I have connections to make it kind of indie budget, and I get the tax credit, et cetera. But I have lived in New York for a while.
Okay. But so there's the Philly connection and then The Social Network. So we're going to talk about The Social Network. Max Minghella, who was in The Social Network, was on the show a few weeks ago. And then Frank Oz was just on the show, who did commentary for an Orson Welles movie, Touch of Evil. And David Fincher has his new Orson Welles movie, Mank, out December. So all of the, there's so many crossovers. Clearly this was fated by the universe to all happen right now. So I had to just call that out. And now I'm going to start with Philly, because if you've grown up in Philly, and this seems to be the conversation I have with most people from Philly, there's not only an allegiance and a passion for the city, but also there's the M. Night coefficient of Philly. It's not rumored, it's true. You said at some point in some interview in the past that my exhaustive research has unearthed that you wanted to be the female M. Night. What is it like growing up in Philly with M. Night hanging over that town? And I'll mention the other two folks, Matt and Dylan, who were on the show, both growing up in Philly, ended up being extras in an M. Night movie. So what is the Venn diagram crossover for you and the M. Night experience?
Yeah, you know, it's so true. I definitely want to be the female M. Night. I have a huge crush on him. I have never done any of his films.
He's not a great actor. He's not a great actor.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've met him. We did together a rally for the Philadelphia tax credit for Sharon Pinkinson, like I think 2 years ago, and it was raining and he held my umbrella. And I think that was like, because he spoke and then I spoke. And I think that might've been the highlight of my life so far.
He
and
held
my
your umbrella.
Was there, I was like, yeah. And I was like, dude, M. Night held my umbrella. Jason, you are in trouble.
That's right. Watch out.
But yeah, I mean, joking aside, I think that Philadelphia is a great place to shoot, and a lot of people don't necessarily know that. There's so many amazing locations, like, you know, the British settled here, the architecture, there's just an array of wealth here. And then the other thing I share with, I believe, M. Night and just about every other Philly person is a huge passion, love-hate relationship with the Philadelphia Eagles. Just want to put that out there.
Are you currently loving them or hating them?
Hating. I hate. I don't even want to get into Carson Wentz and my feelings on that, because I may jeopardize some viewers. But anyway, it's love hate.
And you know, as M. Night himself, it's funny. Like, you know, look, everybody, and I'll get off M. Night in one sec. But you know, he bursts onto the scene with something like The Sixth Sense, and over time, people will call him, you know, Philadelphia's artistic son or whatever it may be. He has a rocky road here or there. He's kind of on the upswing these days. But does he do no wrong in the eyes of Philadelphians, if that's even the correct phrase?
So, I mean, I think what's, you know, everybody, I was thinking about this last night because I was thinking about like what I'm doing next. And I was just like, you know, everybody makes mistakes. And when you start out on a project, you think it's going to be like the best thing, like Oscar winning, et cetera. And along the way, you know, making a movie's like war and things just happen. So, I mean, you know, we're all going to do good and bad things in the art world, I believe. And I think if you don't, you're not taking enough risk, frankly, in terms of making movies. But one other quick M. Night thing that I forgot to mention and just came to me is I actually got married in the church where The Sixth Sense filmed down in Society Hill. Isn't that crazy? Not
that's
intentionally.
Good.
I didn't like book is, it because that of that.
Do you have footage of it?
The wedding? I think we didn't have like a video camera person. It was like 12 years ago. I think we like had some kind of video footage, but I don't know where it is.
I'll never, my wife will never forgive me, because when we were getting married, I was like, she's like, should we hire a videographer? And I was like, what? We have friends, like they'll take pictures, it's fine. And it was one of these things that like years later we never did, and I'll never be forgiven. Anyways, just
Me too. I feel the same way. Yeah. I feel the same way because I said no to a videographer, and I have these, like, we had disposable cameras on the table. The reception was at my mom's house, right, in the suburbs, and like the disposable drunk camera, just, it doesn't do justice to the event.
No, we did that too, and it's like half of the pictures were like people screwing around in the bathroom filming, you know, taking pictures of random stuff. So you can never count on your guests when alcohol is involved to take good pictures. So, okay, so you say you want to be the female M. Night. You clearly, across many of the projects you've worked on, you're not just acting, you're not just writing, you're producing as well. You've the directing pieces may be coming or on the side for the moment. When you look at those folks in the film industry and they cross multiple areas of a film, it's interesting because if you're a writer, a lot of people will say, if you're writing the projects and you're acting and you're producing, why aren't you directing? What is the reason for leaving that piece out of the puzzle?
So I would actually throw that back in a different way and say, why should you be the only eye on a project? And if you're writing, producing, and acting, you need an outside eye to direct you, to criticize you, and tell you when you're going in the wrong way. I mean, I certainly do and plan to direct. I feel that until now, I wasn't qualified. I didn't have enough, frankly, behind the camera experience. I do feel qualified now. But above and beyond that, like, I am involved in the final cut. I have the final cut in all my movies. So I see them from beginning to end, but I also think that filmmaking is a team sport, and to bring on someone else who has your vision too, like a group, you have to have a group vision. And I do believe writing and directing and producing share a lot of commonalities, and you have to have that group vision that's on the same page, but then you can elevate just what you're doing. It's not just you, it's you and someone else, and you can each challenge each other.
What is, I mentioned this to somebody else recently, it was a tweet somewhere, which I'll probably continue to repeat ad nauseum over the next year. There was a screenwriter on Twitter, established screenwriter, talking about their daily schedule, and they said it was like 9 a.m., get up and write, like 9 to 5, you know, 8 o'clock, I'm a total failure. 11 p.m. waking up in bed, I'm a genius. 6 a.m. I suck, and then 9 a.m. starting again. Like, what is your relationship with the process of writing? How psychologically, emotionally, how do you approach it, and what does success look like in a day, in a week? Are you an outliner? Like, what's your process from a writing perspective?
Yeah, I love that. Whoever said that is genius. You know,
and also a failure.
Right. Totally. Aren't we all, right? Isn't that life? Right. You know, as a writer, it totally varies. I've been asked this schedule question. I'm not a schedule person in that I just work. I'm like obsessive when I go on a project. So I work 7 days a week from start of project to end of project. But what I do on a daily basis and how many hours that is totally varies. You know, frankly, right, I'm also a mom. I have a newborn. I have a 7-year-old. Wow. You know, there's lots of complicated things that go into juggling a day. But with writing, you know, I'm better in the morning. I'm not a night person at all. But what I do when I hit a roadblock, other than throw things and curse, I'm a big cursor. I have a really bad mouth, which is a problem when you're 7-year-old. I started saying like, fuck was fire truck. But anyway, you may have to edit that out. I don't know. But my point was, what was my point? Oh, the lucky thing about wearing many hats is that I have the luxury of, like, if I'm at a roadblock with writing, you know, I fundraise for all my movies. I raise all the money. I do the dry work that doesn't require the creative.
Right.
I look at locations, and it gives me a way to stay involved in the project and emotionally sane without, like, I don't beat my head against the wall. Like, I don't keep working in a day where I'm like, you know what, like, I'm turning out junk.
You mix it up. Well, and that is the clearly the advantage of being somebody that's focused on multiple aspects of a film, because if all you're focused on is just writing, then, you know, it can become a very tunnel vision, dejected experience if you're not delivering on one part, right?
Totally. And like, you can be like location scouting, because I do location scouting for all my films very early on, like in the writing process, and you can actually find a location that sparks a creative idea or your casting, right? You know, and you see an actor and you're like, oh my God, like that sparks a new idea. So I think they all help feed each other.
So when the first project that you produced, wrote, acted in was Backwards in 2012, is that right?
That is correct.
So this is a movie, you know, the old adage is write what you know. You rode crew. So this is a movie about a woman who rows crew, who ends up being recruited to coach alongside James Vanderbeek, a group of younger women.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say the inspiration for the film was A, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I had no idea.
That was the inspiration.
I went to Barnes and Noble's and I read books on screenwriting. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. So back to what you were saying,
yeah.
I had to focus on something that I knew intimately. And right. I was an athlete growing up. I played basketball. I was a rower. I was a runner. So I knew sports. And I was obsessed with this idea of, and I still am, frankly, success and what it means when you don't make your goal. You don't get the Oscar, right? You get the nomination. Mm-hmm. You don't get to the Olympics. You are the alternate. And there was a woman I rode with at college who was the alternate for the Olympics. She took time off from college. She trained and she sat on the sidelines. And that to me was just, does she see her life as success? She should, but does she? So that was really, and then Bend It Like Beckham was such an inspiration for me growing up. And I felt like there aren't enough, and I say this as a positive, vanilla. Backwards is a vanilla, PG, Dove, family-friendly films
right.
that you can just watch and aren't edgy. And so that was really the inspiration for that one.
And so when you started, when you decided you were going to do that film, that moment versus the moment at the end when it was done, it was sold, it was released and distributed, what was the original expectation of this is what success looks like? And when you finished, what was that revised kind of assumption of success on that film?
Well, you know, I didn't even think I could do it in the beginning, to be honest. Like, you know, I just said, oh, I'm going to write a movie. And then, like, I didn't know that it was going to really happen and that we were going to get James Vanderbeek and that I think, you know, it's under a 7-figure movie. And yeah. the scale of the movie, I'm very impressed with. You know, at the time, Weinstein was doing Boys in the Boat, and I was worried that that would ruin my chances of raising money, et cetera. And then, you know, when you get to the finish line, obviously, you know, when you're making a film like that on such a low budget, there are things you wish you could do. You know, my script writing has improved since then. But, yep. You know, what was tricky was we did get a lot of coverage, and Rowers, which is who I made this for, loved the film, but it wasn't a critical success, right? The critics didn't like it.
Right.
I think the LA Times liked it. They were the ones that liked it. But that was hard because it was the first time, you know, I was really actually proud of what I did. And I think for what it was, the result was a success. But then the critics were really harsh. And frankly, and I hate this term, they called it a vanity project. And it made me really angry because you don't say that to men. Like, you never hear a man who writes, produces, and stars that it's a vanity project.
Right.
And ultimately, that was the drive for me to do it again. Because at the end of filming, I was like, I'm never doing this again. I'm never making another film. Never, never, never. But then when people started to call it a vanity project, I was like, you know what? But that's not who I am. That's not what this is. I want to tell new stories about women, and I'm going to do it again, and I'm going to prove them wrong. And that was kind of the athlete in me.
So then comes Equity. And I mentioned in the opening before our interview began, I'll never forget, because I remember going to Sundance of 2016. And at the time I was running The Orchard, and we would always go through the lists of, all right, here's all the films. Here's what we know are coming to the festival. Equity was one that jumped to the top of our list again, you know. Wall Street, female protagonists, Anna Gunn, clearly all kind of like really attractive elements of the film, only to arrive in Sundance. And I think literally the night before Sundance began, Classics announced that they picked up the film, which for someone like you and someone involved in that project, that's a dream. Like, you're the 1% to go into Sundance and actually not have to stress over audience reactions, reviews. At the end of the day, it's already been picked up. It's an amazing, you know, way to start the festival. How did that play out for you with respect to that film? Was there a connection with Classics? Because usually when there's a pre-buy like that, there's some relationship that has already been in place.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't, it goes way back to Sundance. I didn't have any connections at Sundance. And I wrote Trevor Groff a cold email, frankly,
yeah.
saying, I'm in the middle of making this Wall Street film. Will you meet with me? And he said, yes, which is so rare. Like, so many of my emails at that point just went completely ignored.
Right.
And I met with Trevor for coffee in LA and told him about the film, and he was interested in, I mean, I think it was a commercial concept. And so what that did is when I went to blind submit to Sundance, because this was before we had a sales agent right. on the project, I was able to update Trevor, and it was because we all know the festival game, right? It was properly watched. It was watched by the right people. And we were lucky enough to get accepted. I still remember I was in the elevator going to the edit room when Trevor called me to say, you got in. And I was like, huh? To Sundance. And then, yeah. And then, and we were still like debating over the final cut. And then, you know, with Sundance specifically, you know, when we got into Sundance, we got some press and then we got a Bloomberg article, and Sony Classics just called and asked for a meeting with myself and my then producing partner on that film, Alicia Reiner. And, you know, we met with them and they pitched us. And then, you know, a day before, and then they saw the film, and a day before Sundance, I get an email in my box from CAA that's like, here's the offer. And the offer was a big offer. Like, my investors made a profit. And I will never forget that moment. I may never have that moment again in my life. You know, you're sitting in hair and makeup for press, for like the pre-press for your premiere. And it's like, oh my God, we're done.
Yeah.
Like, we can go ski.
I mean, no, that's a that, kind of like to hit a pickup before Sundance, your investors are made whole. It's a message. It's a an experience that I think, I mean, I know very few people have going to that festival. So that, I mean, that's amazing. And then to have an established distributor on board. Now, I don't recall who distributed Backwards, but for you going through the experience of then having equity picked up by a major indie distributor with the track record like Classics has, What did that experience, what was that like? What was unexpected for you going through that process? Were you as involved as you wanted to be in the marketing and the release? Was there things that you wished you'd been a part of? Like, how does that play out for you working with someone like Classics?
I love everyone at Sony Classics, Michael, Tom, Dylan, Carmelo, who does the press. I mean, they are, interestingly enough, you hear these like horror stories about like someone picks it up and they take it over. They're no way like that. Like, you know, we made two minor tweaks to the cut, but it was a very, very minor. And it was a very collaborative process. Same with the artwork. They actually put us on basically a 6-month tour around the country for word of mouth, you know, which was amazing. A once in a lifetime experience that frankly I didn't get with A Call to Spy because of the pandemic. But I think, you know, the only differences we had on the release date, it was released kind of 2 weeks before the Olympics, and then there was the election. So we got all this wonderful press, like New York Times critics pick, good box office. And then there was a pause in the expansion because of like the Olympics. And I think it really did kill. And it was also like a July release when like the people who watch Wall Street movies are in the Hamptons. So I mean, that was maybe the only quibble I have, but that's kind of like a quibble because they handled the release itself brilliantly.
No, it's a great film. And again, it's nice to see female protagonists driving that story. And, you know, and interesting to look at how, you know, your character in Equity is this very hungry, driven professional who, I love that there's that sequence where Anna Gunn walks into the bathroom and your character's in there emptying a martini and filling it back up with water because she doesn't want anyone to know that she's pregnant, and how that will impact her trajectory from a professional standpoint. And these are, I mean, it's unique to the protagonist and to that world, but not to women in general in any profession. So it's a great film. I just want to call that out because aside from it, you know, it's a Wall Street film with Anna Gunn. There's a level of just the character's background story and impact of being a woman in that world that I think is really impactful.
Thank you. That's my favorite scene. It's actually based on like a true story. Like there was, my husband worked at Lehman till the bitter end. You know, he was 29. He lost all his money and then kind of started to rebuild. And through his world, that's where I met all these women on Wall Street originally. That was kind of the inspiration for the idea. But anyway, I interviewed a lot of Wall Streeters that were women. And one of the stories was, it's a heavily, you know, you go out for clients and you have to drink. And it was a story that someone told me, like, you know, I get a martini and I dump it out in the sink.
We still have a long way to go.
Yes.
So while Equity is going on, I have to believe, so let's hit A Call to Spy. So A Call to Spy, which, just to call out for folks, released in theaters and on digital as of October. So it's available for anybody who wants to watch it, can, you know, rent, purchase, stream the film. IFC Films released it. You spent like 4 years doing the research on Virginia Hall and Churchill's Secret Army, probably back to, you know, 2016. Is that right?
Yes. Started on the press tour, actually.
And where did you originally hear about this story, these stories in general?
So interestingly enough, as a filmmaker, I actually start with the genre that I think will be commercial and frankly make my investors money back, because that's how I have a career. And then I look at it from an independent film lens and a female lens of what stories haven't been told before, because I'm a big believer in original content. So anyway, sports film, Wall Street film, spy film. So I knew I wanted to do a spy film, and I knew I wanted to do, I'd studied World War II extensively at Williams College. I knew I played Ava Braun off Broadway. Like I knew this time period, but I didn't know, and I knew about Churchill's Secret Army, but I didn't know about the women in detail. So that's where the research started. And when I came across the three women, you know, I chose to portray who I call kind of the hidden figures of the spy world, and then realized, much like the research I did with Equity, hey, there's never been a movie about these women before. And they're heroes and they've won all these awards and they're incredible women. That was kind of the aha moment to dig deeper into the research and get access to their spy files and just make this movie.
And you spent time interviewing Virginia's family, remaining family that are still in Europe. Where are they at?
They're here. They're in Maryland, Linda, Lorna, and Brad Catling. And I did interview them. And that was actually really important because, you know, Virginia Hall is an enigmatic person. She never gave any interviews, obviously, because she was a spy. When she was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, she turned down the president giving it to her because she didn't want to blow her cover. She just did it in secret with, you know, her mom. So the point is, well, I had access to the facts and her words and letters that she wrote back when she was a spy in the field in Europe. Nobody really knows what she was like, not even her living relatives. So what was really helpful for me as an actor trying to play this real person was the details the family could provide about her limp, about she called herself cantankerous, you know, about she was always in pain. She was the pirate chief in the school plays. She was head of the basketball team. These details just gave me what her personality is that nothing else could.
And so talk about how do you, this is your idea. You do the research. Have you already written the script before you're pulling together financing and your director, Lydia Dean Pilcher? What's the process there?
Sure. So I do it kind of all at once. Well, first I write the script. I mean, you have to end the business plan. Like, you can't raise money without a script and a business plan, in my view, because many of my investors say, okay, let me read the script. So I did a business plan on why I thought this would make money. And you know, part of even who I put in this movie is how do I fundraise in it, right? So by, you know, Noor Nayat Khan is in this movie and she's a hero within, you know, the UK and within India. And I was going to cast a real Indian top celebrity. And that was part of the business plan that I pitched. And I was able to bring in investors from the Indian American community, right? So anyway, I digress. But the point is, I do it kind of all at the same time. A lot of the fundraising, like any other filmmaker, you know, you're never done fundraising, comes all the way through the film. I lost $600,000 in fundraising a week before shooting.
Oh, wow.
And I had, and that's a huge, huge, huge portion of the budget. And I never lost money before. Somebody wanted a preference over other investors, and I never do that. So anyway, long story short, I had to, like, instead of preparing for acting or anything like that, like, I had to just hit the ground and every day of shooting continue the fundraising process just to get it in the can and then make up the difference in post. So, you know, like anyone else, I have horror stories on how this film got made. In terms of Lydia, you know, I interviewed like 100 directors for this job. You know, a lot of women and two good men were right. Like, we're not getting the job. And I was like, no, joking aside, I think Lydia was a good fit for this one because of her international background, and specifically her background working on films in India. She really connected to the Norse storyline. She just seemed like a good fit for this one.
I mean, my mind spins when I think about a movie like this, a period piece. You know, you're watching the film and you've got your picture cars and your wardrobe, and it's a bit overwhelming to imagine the financials.
So, you know, it's all the same indie filmmaking trips. I mean, you know, this is a budget that is under $5 million. Yeah. So, and I don't know that I've even disclosed that before, but it is. And so it was, you know, that was the challenge of the film.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did, and this goes back to Philly that we started on in the beginning, is finding your resources. So I found a home. It's called Ardrossan Estate on the Main Line. And it is actually the real life home of the family that inspired the Philadelphia Story, interestingly enough.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, and it's on the Main Line and it's fully furnished with period furniture. It's an estate, right? And it is a replica, an exact replica of the family's Scottish ancestral home, which is a similar replica to where these spies historically trained, because they trained in mansions in the Scottish hillside. So when I found that and convinced them to let us shoot there, what we were able to do, I think we shot like, I don't know, a quarter of the film there. We shot there for like 11 days, 10, 11 days. We shot fully dressed, so we didn't have to do period furniture, right? First floor, we shot every room and that was all the training. And then we went down to the basement and we shot the torture. And we went up to the third floor and we dressed it for inside Paris and Noir. And then we went outside and this tree was Scotland and this tree was London. I mean, it really was that. But I think what really brought the scale to this film in a big way was that we did go to Budapest for a short time. And we worked with Pioneer Pictures, which is an amazing female-led production company. And that's where we got the trucks. You know, we never could have afforded that in the United States. And you know, the faces of the extras are European and more authentic. That's where the scale came.
I mean, the fact that you can film, who knew you could film France, you could, you know, Philly for France and England. I mean, I didn't know that.
Well, I didn't either till I started. I mean, I knew you could do London because I knew that the British, you know, came here first. And I, from living here and growing up here, I knew there was a lot of historical landmarks here. But we researched everything. We looked at Canada. I looked at London. I looked at France. It just wasn't in the budget. So then it became, okay, how do we make this work? Because again, for me, you know, there's certain things I would have loved to do if I was David Fincher and had, you know, $40 million for this movie. But the fact of the matter is I believe in getting the thing done because no one else was going to make it. And I try that with all my films and no one else ever does. So you just have to make it the way that you can and the best that you can.
So now as someone so involved in so many facets of a production like this, there are things that you wished you could have done, and I'm sure I'm going to ask you this. There's, what is that one thing that in hindsight, whether it was based on budget or schedule or cast or whatever, what was the one thing that you wished you had accomplished that you didn't? And then now that it's done and you watch the film, A, can you watch your films once they're done? And B, if you do, is there something in the film that every time, that maybe we won't notice, but you notice and it like... It gives you like agita.
Yes. you know, in terms of what I wish I could have done and couldn't do, and I'm actually working on now is, you know, I would have loved to make this a miniseries, and I am working on that as a spinoff, and we'll see if that lands. But, you know, I just think that these women's lives are so rich, and we had to leave on the cutting room floor their home life because it's a 2-hour movie and you have to follow plot and structure. Right. So, you know, that is my overall, you know, never could get anyone at that time to pick up kind of a larger, more in-depth story of these women. In terms of things that make me cringe when I watch it.
You only have to tell us one.
well, yeah, right. I'm trying to think. You know, it's more like I have memories of what it was to shoot that and what went wrong and what it could have been or what it might've been in the script. I don't think it's one thing. I think it's just like, oh, if we could have gotten that, oh, it was 4 a.m. and we ran out of time and we couldn't go into overtime. You know, it's a lot of little things.
There's a moment, and you know, for people who haven't seen the movie, Virginia Hall, she was known as the limping lady. The Germans gave her the nickname of Artemis, but she had a wooden leg. And there's a point where the character pulls up her pant leg to show that she's got a wooden leg, right? Is that just this is me and my random questions. Is that just a piece of wood on top of your leg? How are you shooting that?
So So we did it many different ways. We started by, like, I actually researched the prostheses of the time, which were, interestingly enough, only made for men, so didn't fit women. Oh, but I digress. But anyway, we bought an old prosthesis wood, and then the art department kind of cut it so that it fit on my leg, and in the back it was open and it was tied. So in that shot, that's what it is. And then that was tied to my back. And then, like, by day seven, because they're heavy, they're 10 pounds, my back went out and I couldn't walk. Oh, so wow. We had to find a new method. So then what we did is, styrofoam. And then there was, something made for my leg out of plaster for, like, when she's in the bed and you see the stump, like, my leg's in the bed, and then we have something just, like, attached to my leg as a special effect. Yeah. But I did, after shooting, rupture my Achilles tendon on that leg because of all this, and couldn't walk for a year. So it was kind of like, oh, art, gosh, imitating life, imitating art, I guess.
Jeez, the sacrifices you make for art in this world.
I know. That's not a good one, because that'll live with me forever, but gave me a whole new appreciation of Virginia Hall.
How would people describe, how are you from a perspective, like, we're going to talk about The Social Network, you know, in, it was funny when I was chatting with Max Minghella, who had a role in The Social Network, I asked him, there was a moment in the film where his character has just realized that Facebook has been stolen by Zuckerberg. He's sitting with some friends, and he gets up and is racing out of this auditorium, and he trips and he falls. And I had asked Max, much like my small little, you know, detail focused questions, I said to Max, is that you falling? And he just captured it. And he said, come on, like, this is Fincher. And as you look at the press of his new movie coming out, everything is so engineered down to the second with him. That's just how he's known. And people want to work with Fincher. They know they're going to do 50 takes on a particular shot. When people work with you, you're clear. I mean, anybody that does, you know, wears all these hats is a type A personality. And that's not a negative. That's just proactive, driven type A personality. Is that how, you know, you think people, how do they view you as a writer, as a producer in the space?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why I responded to The Social Network in such a visceral way, is the detail. I'm very detail oriented. Like, while we don't have the budget for 50 takes, we have the budget for 4, maybe 5 takes if you're lucky, right, in my films, which is a downside. I mean, I think acting benefits from more takes, but you know, everything in my writing is there for a purpose, from, like, the potatoes, which is historically accurate, to, I'm talking about A Call to Spy, to, like, you know, my character, she doesn't use an umbrella. It's very subtle in the beginning. And then at the very end, you just see her with an umbrella in the rain, because she's grown and she's become more cautious from this, like, you know, earlier figure. So I'm very detailed. I would say that, you know, I'm tough, and I say that as a positive. Like, sure. In other words, I have this kind of girl next door persona, and I love people, and I'm very friendly, but when push comes to shove, I'm going to fight for everything in Final Cut that I believe my investors need to see, and I believe is the most commercial product. And so, you know, I guess that's how people see me. You know, I'm driven to make the best product I possibly can, and I won't stop no matter what, no matter budget, until it's the best that it can be for what it is.
It is. And again, this is only, I live in a home of, except for my dog, all women, 2 daughters and a wife, all very driven type A personalities. And so I witnessed kind of firsthand, being married to somebody like that, who's a professional in the industry, that it's not fascinating, it's frustrating. I think if you're a type A personality and you're driven and you believe in what you're fighting for, a lot of the male coefficient can look at that, and they will categorize a woman in a different way than they will categorize, like, you're difficult.
Totally.
Right?
Totally. Versus, but you would never say that to a man, no. I guess is what I'm saying, when you're just, and I'm not like a yeller or anything like that. I just am pushy. You know, like, yeah. I believe at the end of the day that I have to make my investors their money back, and that it is art and business, and that there has to be a cut of a certain length. It can't be 2 hours and 30 minutes, because I'm not David Fincher, right? It's got to be 2 hours. So anyway, I digress, but you're so right. Like, if you're tough as a woman, there's so many words that come floating at you that you would never hear if you were a man. And we're not over that.
No, you know, battle. No, it's a work in progress, clearly. All right, so let's hit the social network. So this comes out in 2010, budget of $40 million, grosses over $200 million, awards up the wazoo. When do you first see the film? What is it about? I mean, I think we kind of have a sense a little bit already why you connected to this film. I personally can watch this film along with Moneyball any hour of any day. But talk to us about why the film and what is it specifically that you love so much about it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not the obvious choice, right? Because I'm a female-driven, right. filmmaker, and this is, I don't particularly like the depictions of women in this movie, actually. But if you put that aside, it's a brilliant movie. And what really appeals to me is the structure, and not just like David Fincher's perfection and structure, but Aaron Sorkin. You know, I did my thesis on Harold Pinter. I'm all about every word is there for a reason, mm-hmm. not to say that there isn't a dialogue because actors have to feel comfortable saying it, and you don't work the script all the way through the shoot. You do and edit, but I'm not someone who's bringing a blueprint of a script to a set either, right? And Pinter has the pause and the silence, and each word's there for a reason. And Aaron Sorkin is that, except he's so dialogue heavy that it's fascinating, and he's so witty. And to me, this could have been a boring courtroom drama. It just could have been a boring courtroom drama. I'm watching, The Undoing on HBO. Yep. Great series. And actually, I'm loving the courtroom drama, but like now we've turned into the courtroom drama, the Law and Order, and they're sitting, and it's not very kinetic in energy. And the fact that the structure of this movie going back and forth in time, and how different people remember different things, much like Pinter's Old Times, which was a show I did in college as well, like how you remember things, made it kinetic. What is basically a dialogue courtroom drama is not at all that. And it's about the people. And I think the producing, writing, and acting is just so incredible on that. As a side note, and I mentioned this in the podcast, I actually met the Winklevoss twins. I wrote at Henley, and I asked the Winklevoss twins for money for Backwards, and they said no. So there was actually like a personal connection, because wow. I know that. Yeah. And I didn't know Armie Hammer before this movie. And I remember having a crush on him in 2010 when I was like, who's that hottie? but yeah, there you go.
It's interesting. The dialogue. I've been a Sorkin fan for a long time, back to even like the Sports Night of the world. But yeah, every word is there for a reason. The rhythm, the cadence, he's the perfect partner in a creative endeavor to David Fincher, because he's that anal about, you know, every word that is on the page is a word to be spoken. But also, to your point, the Rashomon style of the film, that everybody's kind of story and perspective is unique unto themselves, it's a compelling watch over and over and over again. Is there, when you watch the film, is there a particular sequence in the film that kind of rises above anything else for you?
Well, I just love the voyeuristic windows so if you watch the movie and you look at how, you know, even in the party scenes, right? Because it's a movie about connection, right? And it was interesting to watch now, since Facebook is so much bigger, and I believe we've lost connection as human beings because of the internet instead of gained it. But it's really about like connecting with people and how we do it. And what's so interesting to me in the visuals of the movie, even the last scene in the movie, when you're in this glass, you know, conference room, but the position of the actors are so far away and they're still so distant, is how there's walls, you know, literally in front of your viewing at certain points in the film, and emotionally it really resonates with, you know, are these people connecting? Are they connecting in the frat parties? No, they're not. You know, are they connecting on the computer? No, they're not. And that human need for connection.
Yeah, it could almost be called at this point a look back in documentary form of the downfall of of our society.
Totally.
Hopefully we'll reverse the course. Well, the commentary is great. There's really great insights for that. I want to thank you for taking the time to record that whole commentary, which, as everybody who now has been listening to the show knows, will be a subsequent episode with just specifically the commentary for The Social Network. But I want to thank you. I'm going to still call you Sarah Megan Thomas. I can't get rid of the middle name now.
I love it. It's all good.
You'll forever be known to me as that. I'm not even going to use your electric bill last name.
Wait, I have to tell you a really funny story before we go. Like the first, one of the very first red carpets I did, they called me Sarah Morgan Thomas. And my husband was like, you know, you're so famous, they can't even get your name right. So I've lived in, so whenever, that's my name in the house, Sarah Morgan Thomas.
That would, and can you imagine, like there's a story there of an actress whose name is spoken incorrectly and she becomes famous and she must sign on to the name that wasn't hers.
Oh yeah, totally.
But for folks, but to remind folks, A Call to Spy is available now on every digital and streaming platform to buy and rent, as is Equity, as is Backwards. Yes.
Yeah.
So the trilogy, the beginning trilogy before the next five other trilogies that come out of your prolific brain are all available to watch. And want to thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah. Thank you.
And with that, we find ourselves at the end of one of two episodes with Sarah Thomas. I've excised the Megan because it was mandated by SAG, and we don't do anything mandated by SAG here on the Sidetrack. Don't forget, you should check out all three of Sarah Thomas's films, where she is indeed a triple threat of acting, producing, and writing. The 2012 film Backwards, the 2016 Sundance film Equity, and most recently available now, A Call to Spy. And what of The Social Network? Well, Sarah Thomas's feature-length audio commentary is available as the subsequent episode here on the Sidetrack. So download the film. You can find it on all digital platforms. Cue it up and enjoy listening to her commentary. It's a good commentary. It's a great film. And what better... what better thing to do this time of the year? What else do you have to do? We're watching movies. That is what we're doing. So, with regards to the podcast, the three R's remain in effect. Rate, review, retweet. Let folks know about the show if you're a fan of it. If you need to get in touch with us, because, of course, you're waking up at 3 in the morning and have burning questions for us, a simple email will suffice. Sidetrackcast@gmail.com. And if you'd like to support the podcast, which we're, hey, no pressure, do what you want to do. We're not the boss of you. You can find the link to our anchor page in the description of this or any Sidetrack episode, where a mere 99 cents a month will support some aspect of a podcast like this. As always, Paul Davidson at the helm. Thank you. We'll see you next week. Here on the Sidetrack.